The Pick Six podcast is back.
It is.
It's
We're in the studio. So the voice is going to, the audio is going to sound better.
It'll be a little bit better. Yeah. John the Ottawa, Sam McEwen. It's been a while, I feel like. I don't know if it might have been
several months
since I've been able to chat with you about sports.
Has anything happened in that time?
I don't know.
Sports wise?
Probably not, really. I guess the NBA playoffs, nothing happened.
No, it's pretty much status quo.
NBA or Major League Baseball, really, there's not a lot.
1 year later, it's 2-0 in the NBA Finals, just like it was then. Nothing has changed. It's pretty much everything. You could have just frozen the season and reanimated it to this point, and it's the same thing. Pretty amazing.
Just the Warriors are just a little bit better.
They're a little bit better.
Maybe a lot bit better.
But don't be surprised if things, take a turn now.
I don't know how much they can turn. I feel like Cleveland can steal a game.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe
Gordon
two. Gordon
take a miss shots.
You know what's what sticks out when I watch this series? Because I didn't watch any of the playoffs. I'm not going to lie.
Were you a little busy?
A little bit, but
you had a lot of stuff.
A little bit,
on.
But then again, I was just like, you know what? It's not appealing to me.
Sure.
I had every now and then I'd have 45 minutes or an hour to kill it in the evening, and I'd turn on hockey and just watch the third period.
Been good.
But what's incredible to me is just the amount of physicality on the court, and how I don't understand or I don't really have a way to assess how referees make their calls in this game. I mean, LeBron is one of the most physical basketball players ever. And when he's going through the lane or when he's bodying up to grab a rebound or, shot faking, it's just unreal to me. I mean, Draymond's a really physical dude. I feel like Durant has been posted up at times, so he's had to be physical defensively to, match Kevin Love's size. It's every time down, it seems like I understand that they're not. It's not like the old good old days, you could say, I don't even know if they were good, but the days of yore that we always go nostalgic
about.
It's not
probably as physical as the 92 Knicks Bulls conference.
That's what I'm saying. It's not like the late 80s.
It's very, very close.
Gosh, it's crazy.
Yeah. And Durant is sort of like a trump card because he's so tall, and he's actually pretty decently built for a man his size and his speed, his shoulders, I mean. And so he's almost like a trump card. Like, you can't really, he's a hard guy to defend. And Durant has always been kind of not a deferential player, but almost like I'm going to turn this on in spurts.
Yeah.
But the guy that we've seen in the first two games, is certainly equal to LeBron James. Now, it doesn't mean that he's equal to him, overall. But in those two games, he was. He was every bit the player that LeBron was.
LeBron, kind of defend him there for a while. For a couple
hard,
stretches.
It's hard, though. Well, 7 foot versus
I'd agree that.
6'9"? Yeah, 6'8 and a half. So it's hard.
Who are you rooting for right now?
For the Warriors.
You are rooting for the Warriors?
Oh, yeah. I'm a Warriors fan. I'm a Warriors and a Trailblazers fan from when I was a kid. So I am rooting for the Warriors. I rooted for the Golden State Warriors when they had Baron Davis and Steven Jackson. So I think I'm going to go ahead and continue to root for them, even though they're great.
Well, okay,
I can't not. I understand the super team thing and all that.
Yeah,
I wish that Durant wasn't there either. Not because I don't like Kevin Durant, but because I would have loved to have seen this team take a crack at the Cavs without Durant. But now that he's there, I'm not going to, I'm not going to make him feel bad for it.
I have a hard time though. I'm watching the game and Durant's talking trash and does something spectacular. He's talking trash. Steph Curry pulls up from 30 feet, nails it, talks trash. You got Draymond always talking, and the fans are going crazy these first two games. The arena goes is nuts. And I just can't appreciate it because I'm like, Durant is the second best player in the world, and he just joined the team that probably would have won the entire thing last year if a couple things didn't happen.
Didn't get suspended.
I was going to say, if Steph Curry didn't get hurt or Draymond didn't get suspended, then they probably, essentially, they're the best team. They just set a record for wins. So the second best player just joined the best team. So from a basketball fan standpoint, I have a hard time grappling with my emotions because I don't fault Kevin Durant for the decision that he made. If I were in his shoes, of course, I'm like, you only get to play basketball and for a short amount of time in your life. Do it, have fun, win a championship, whatever makes you happy. I'm fine with that. But it hurts me just watching these games as my like competitive fire. I'm like, they're too good, Sam. They're just too good.
Yeah. And Durant, I think, joined the Warriors for actually the best reasons. I don't think he joined them because they were winners. I think he joined them, well, A, because they had the room to pay for him, but B, because I think he actually syncs up with the values of the head coach. I think Kerr and Curry are two key reasons, and Draymond Green and Clay. I think he actually believes in what they're doing. And he wants to play for a team that believes in the way that the Warriors are playing. I think part of the challenge there is that, you know, Golden State had the room based on having certain guys that, you know, in their initial contracts. There was a really good story written by Zach Lowe of ESPN.com about how it is the NBA has changed in just the last couple of years because of the way they changed the cap.
Yep.
And it gave the Warriors the ability to go out and basically give Kevin Durant the money. That said, I actually think Kevin Durant would take less money and stay. And people don't like hearing that, but I think he might do it. I don't really think he cares that much. I think he's that one guy who really is that kind of person. And I don't know. He's always been like that. Like, even when he won the MVP award and he spent all that time talking about everybody else. And there's something in him that just makes him
generally seems like a good dude.
Right. I think it's one of these situations where, yes, it's frustrating, but the person who is catalyzing this, I don't know that he's doing it for the sake of his own legacy. I think he's kind of doing it because he wants to actually be a part of something. And I think, I don't know, I guess you're a millennial. I think it's kind of a millennial thing. I really do. I think when you look at LeBron James, even though he is in the age of a millennial, technically 34, whatever he is, he isn't one at all.
I think he's like 30, man.
LeBron? Yeah, maybe he is. No, I thought he was like 32.
Maybe. I thought it was like my age.
Maybe he is. I don't know.
32.
But he doesn't really act like a millennial. He acts like a classic 1982 alpha in some ways. Durant has the personality of a guy that really just wants to be a part of something larger, and Golden State is that thing. It's like, if they win the NBA, let's say they sweep the NBA title, and they sweep the Cavs, they are the best professional team in the world at what they do. Correct? Fair?
Yeah.
So, why wouldn't you want to be a part of the best professional sports team in the world? Period.
Who else could compete? I mean, like the Patriots?
Yes.
They'd compete. Maybe like Real Madrid?
Yes. Brazil soccer?
Just like the
it's
entity.
Not a professional team.
But. Like maybe Germany would be better.
Germany?
Like the German national team, but.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're right up there.
The U.S. Ryder Cup team last year, but that doesn't really count because, you know, that was a national team.
It's based on what they've just done previously or recently, but also what they can accomplish going forward. I mean,
and the thing is, they're doing that with, like, how many guys are on the roster? 14, 12?
Mm-hmm.
To be able to do that, to say you are a part of the best professional sports team on earth, which means you're the best sports team on earth, is a pretty special distinction. And it's hard to say that you don't want to do that. Like, in soccer, which you follow way more than I do, there are kind of some super teams, are there not?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So it's a hard thing to turn down. This is what the NBA has become. It's a players' league. It can be frustrating at times. I would love to see the Washington Wizards, who I think are one player short of having this, I'd love to see them get one more piece and then take their swing at Golden State because I adopted them this year as my East Conference team
to follow.
And I love watching them.
I'm curious about, like, maybe LeBron. Maybe LeBron can in this group. I don't know what the cap situation is or how long they can stick together. But you would imagine whoever is on LeBron's team, they'll be the best team in the East for a couple more years at least. The Warriors are going to be the best team in the West for a couple more years at least.
Yes.
So what are we going to lose in that time frame from, you know, the last 2 years to the next three? So like this 5-year stretch, what are we going to miss? Because no one else really seriously has a chance, it seems like.
Doesn't seem like it. Although apparently Boston has the money. But I don't know what that means. Like, they have the money to go get it.
Is it gonna fracture the league to a point where it's
players would have to be fed up. And the players are the ones that wanted this.
Well, they're making a lot of money because of it, yeah. So they're probably not gonna complain about it. But yeah.
I'm not sure that a lot of the players in the NBA, I think there are some who absolutely burn and die to win and lose. John Wall does. I don't know that that describes a lot of guys in the NBA. I don't know. I really don't know.
It doesn't.
There's not a lot of Kobe Bryants in the league anymore.
Yeah, that's
Kobe was Kobe.
Right.
And I don't like Kobe Bryant. But one thing I can say about Kobe is it was like drinking sulfur poison. For him to
Westbrook
lose.
Westbrook kind of feels like that.
Westbrook does too.
I don't know.
Right?
Harden sort of got an edge this year, it seemed like. But
James Harden is. You look up Mercurial in the dictionary and you see a picture of him.
Yeah. But
well, I'm hoping the Wizards get one more guy because I think John Wall really does care.
Yeah.
Like he wants to take that team and that city, which has won nothing for years.
Right.
I don't know, 25 years. He wants to take that team and that city.
Chris Paul seems like a competitor, but he might join the Spurs. So,
Chris Paul does, but I don't know that he was playing with guys that necessarily felt the same
way.
That's
what I'm saying. But he kind of feels like one of those alpha dudes that like he'll do whatever it takes. Actually, to a fault, I felt like, especially during the last few years in the playoffs, man, he tried too hard.
But you look at Blake Griffin; he's not going to be as good as LeBron James. There's only one of him. But Blake could be one of the 10 best players in the NBA annually. He's not. Why?
Didn't he have a decent manager?
He gets hurt a lot. There's a lot of different reasons why Blake isn't as good as he should be. But I just don't know that it's always top of mind for every NBA star.
Yeah.
I think the 80s were unique in that you had Isaiah and Magic and Bird and Kareem, and you had like these star and Dr. J, who hadn't won a title until 82, who really wanted it. And then in the 90s, you had the consummate all-time competitor in Michael Jordan. And I think a lot of other teams wanted to knock him off just to say they did. And he kind of set that tone. The one area where I wouldn't compare LeBron and Michael is in that sort of all-consuming, you know, enough players have talked about it now to know that there's something about LeBron that's just not going to ever be quite like Michael in that way. That, in fact, in some ways, LeBron may be a more graceful human being.
I was going to say, it might be better. LeBron would be better off for it.
Yeah.
All right. Who you got?
Golden State.
How many games will Cleveland win now that
two.
You've seen two? We're recording this on a Tuesday. So
yeah, two.
I'd say this. They get one. Because, you know, the games have been semi-close. Cleveland's never really gone on a run. Maybe at home, it'll be able to get some calls in its favor. Home court advantage does matter, and so maybe that helps. But it sure does seem like Golden State.
I enjoy talking about the NBA Finals, so I think I like the NBA.
I mean, it's pretty fascinating to watch because one of the things, as ridiculous as Golden State is, they're still playing the best player. Like they're going up against the best player in the world in LeBron.
Yeah.
So he does spectacular things. Kyrie Irving is already a phenomenal watch. You know, he may drive you crazy at times because he's dribbling too much or trying to showboat a little bit too much,
right.
or trying ridiculous finishes, but he makes some of them. So that's fun. And then the Golden State side, I mean, you got Steph Curry raining threes from all over the place. The defensive efforts by Draymond, Kevin Durant, when he's up at this highest level that he's been at these last two games. So there's reasons to watch.
Aesthetically, do you like watching Kyrie Irving?
I don't like him playing in a team setting. I'd love to just watch him ball in a one-on-one setting.
Okay.
All day. That'd be great. But yeah, it does seem like when he has the ball in his hands, it's either going to be a highlight or a scratch your head, contested jump shot or floater or layup or something. But anyway, yeah. So
yeah, I'm not a big fan of his game aesthetically.
What's going on with Nebraska football? This is like we're just entering June, so it kind of heats up a little bit, at least for the coaching staff. I don't know if there's a ton of news ever to report, but you sort of set pieces in place for the fall. What's going on?
Team just got back from vacation in May. So from the end of May, end of school until June 1, a lot of guys go home. Whatever. Some of them stay on campus. A lot of them go home, and then they come back. So they just got back over the weekend. Freshman report. I'm going to say Elijah Blades and Deontay Watts are the two guys that aren't there, but I think everybody else is. And maybe there might be one more. Satellite camps are going on right now where they go down. It's kind of a...
Remind me, what's the rule change in... Does it matter for Nebraska if they change it?
Not terribly. The university's got to host them, and only assistant coaches can work them. So they can't have GAs, and they can't...
And
they
Mike
can't,
Riley
they,
can't go.
Well, he that, can't.
Oh, yes. He can go.
Mike is working all the camps.
Okay, so what they did last year, where they hosted that satellite camp at...
Calabasas.
Well, they didn't... do it. They moved it because of
whatever,
the fire.
High school.
Yeah, to a different high school. If they wanted to recreate something like that, they'd have to host it at a university in California.
Correct.
And they couldn't bring their whole crew, which they brought pretty much everybody, I feel like.
And they couldn't bring, and they couldn't have personal trainers and high school coaches and work in the thing.
Mm.
Right. So there's a little bit difference there.
But from Nebraska's standpoint, I feel like that...
Not a ton.
They can still do what they want to do, which is kind of just get eyeballs on kids and start... developing relationship.
Yes. It's kind of a... So when you go to camps that are hosted by other universities, you're kind of at the mercy of those camps and what they want to do with those camps. For example, at the A&M camp, it was reported that, there was like 700 kids there. Well, Nebraska, when they went to the Calabasas camp, how many kids were there?
Ooh, 150, maybe?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the difference being there that it's a much smaller group of people, and you have a real good sense of who most of those people are.
Yeah.
Because you've kind of arranged that ahead of time. Like, it's not just, hey, some kid from, Flagstaff, Arizona, come on by.
Yeah.
No. At A&M, it's 800 kids or however many it is, and they're all going there, and they're all trying to get a scholarship from, like, 20 different schools. So Nebraska's at the mercy of these schools, I guess is my point. So they're going to go into camps where there's just a crap load of kids. So it's going to be hard to pick out who you want to pick out. It's not going to be as easy to figure out. You're not always going to know who the kid is that you want to pick out, and it's also going to be hard for the kids to get enough reps for you to feel confident about who they are.
Mm-hmm.
So that's part of what happens at the satellite camp now. When they went to Calabasas, if they wanted Keyshawn Johnson to do 4 or 5 reps in a row, Keyshawn Johnson could do 4 or 5 reps in a row.
Yeah, if they wanted a bookie to go one-on-one with Tyjon Lindsey,
they did it.
And they did it.
Well, at these satellite camps, that's up to A&M or FIU, Lane Kiffin, or FAU or Mercer. You don't have any control over it. So it's a little bit different and a little bit harder.
And, if 700 kids, it's going to be harder to have that personal connection when you're talking about all the coaches that I'm sure are around there on the sidelines. So.
Right. So yeah. I think there's a little bit of a challenge there. Then they're going to have their Friday Night Lights camps, and that's where they kind of self-select. They'll have some walk-up kids that come, but they know who all the guys are that they want. They put numbers on them. They have a pretty good idea. And they're really excited this year about the 2019 prospects who are going to come. They've identified pretty much everybody in the 2018 class in terms of who's where on their board. Now, they're going to offer a few extra guys at tackle, maybe at wideout. Their wideout board always goes at seemingly 130 guys deep, and then they end up a guy short. This year, they won't. They're going to end up getting
That's
their
probably
nice.
Good.
But they always
shoot for the moon at that wideout spot, though. So
they offered a kid. So Rivals, who's down there, reported they offered a kid. They should have offered like months ago. I don't know what was going on, but they offered this kid from the middle of Texas. He's a really good player. He's like 6'5" and, you know, 210,
yeah.
Runs real well for his size. Like, why didn't you guys offer this guy earlier? Like, what was, because they offer this other kid in Texas who's going to Tommy Bush, who's like a high force, them not right, coming. Right. So they've done a pretty good job of building their 2018 board. Now it's on to 2019. They're going to get some kids they want in here to like chat with them for the 2019 class. And I think they feel like they're in really good shape. They feel like they're ahead of the game. They feel like they've done a lot of diligent work identifying prospects and getting this thing back to where they want it, which is we've got to get the best players possible in this program. The starting line for these kids has to be, what am I trying to say? The floor for these kids has to be higher. I think that Nebraska was dealing oftentimes under the Bow era with a lower floor and hoping that ceiling would go way up.
Yeah.
They got to get that floor higher.
Well,
they got to recruit kids who are willing to have the high ceiling too.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, one of the things is, like, you know, previously, I think Nebraska, it was shooting for, you know, if we can get that high ceiling kid, then that's great. But we also can find these diamond in the roughs or these kind of, you know, maybe under recruited, under the radar type guys too. So, like, that's where we can. We always know that's sort of our crutch. We can go back to that if we don't get these top-tier guys. But I think from my estimation, what you're saying and what I've observed from the outside is just Nebraska's not wasting time trying to, like, sift through the weeds and hope that it lands on some really top-tier right. guy or potential field guy. Sure, they'll take those guys every now and then, but they really are, you know, raising their standards. Which you kind of
raise, yeah, they want to raise the floor.
Yeah.
Like a good example is Givens Price, who I think was an interesting player at Nebraska. He has a very high ceiling because he came to Nebraska when he was 16.
Yeah.
But his floor was low because he was 16. He's on an NFL roster now. So he had the ability, but his floor was so low when he started because of his age and because of his underdevelopment that getting to his ceiling was going to take him all the way up until he got into the pros. That's where Nebraska's got to move away from. They got to move more toward the higher floor kids. Like Marlon Lucky's a good example. High floor, kind of a lower ceiling. But guess what? Marlon could play right away. And he did play.
Yeah.
And he was pretty good. Doesn't mean he was a great NFL player. He wasn't Amir Abdullah. But his floor was high.
If you happen to have three Marlon Luckys on your team.
Great.
Yeah. Then you're talking about
that's terrific,
taking that next step.
Right?
Yeah.
So, like, that's what they've got. It's a hard thing to explain to people because they're like, what are you talking about? Floors? Ceilings? What? Don't you want them all? No. There's a difference between a low floor and a high floor. You want more kids in your program who are high floor. If they start there, then you don't have to work as hard to develop them. Lamar Jackson has a high floor. I don't know how Lamar's ceiling could be really high. It's up to Lamar, but his floor is high. He can run, and he can cover deep, and he'll do a lot of that this year. So, you know, I think that's a big part of it, John, is just trying to figure that stuff out. So they've got the camps, and then, you know, they'll have captains here probably in June.
Gotcha.
They'll probably elect those. I'm sure Tanner will be one of them.
I expect
Tanner to be one of them.
Have you been surprised at all just about how quickly he's sort of adapted to that role? Because it was like instantly, as soon as we saw some interviews with him, I don't know. I didn't go to practice, but I'd imagine he had the same sort of demeanor on the field. Like, you know, he understands that there's a competition going on, but like he's carrying himself like he's going to start and that he has responsibility to set the tone and, you know, set an example. It just seems like he's really bought into that that role, and he did it from the start, which like he's on the team. He was around before, but he's redshirting, so maybe that was part of it. It just sort of like I've talked to guys before who've joined programs as transfers, and that redshirt year, you're really just trying to fit in and feel things out, and you also don't know if it's your place to step up and say things because you know you're not making an impact on the field. But as soon as that flipped, like the season, the calendar turned,
And it started before that.
It did.
For Tanner, I think it all fell into place really easily. I think he got here. He fit in with the guys. They liked him. He's different. He was enough different from Tommy. And Tommy and he, his playing time weren't going to coincide.
Yeah, yeah.
So Tommy was going to be a graduating senior, ditto for Riker. So he didn't have any relational competition with those guys. Like, he could be cool with Tommy and Riker knowing that they were never going to play in Nebraska when he did. And so the guys, he could get close to guys under that same umbrella. Like, these guys would be like, look, you're not going to beat Tommy out. Tommy's not going to beat you. We're going to get to know you. And so he actually made a lot of headway with the seniors, the guys that were seniors last year. They liked him. And that was part of it. And then another part of it was his competition for who he was competing with behind Tommy in terms of leadership. He and Patrick just aren't the same level of maturity.
Mm.
And
which makes
gravitas.
Sense. He's been around longer.
But I want to be clear that, like, if it had been Tristan Jebbia and Tanner Lee, it would have been more interesting. And that doesn't mean that I think that Tristan's better than Patrick. I think Patrick has a lot of ability, and I think we haven't seen Patrick's best football yet. But Tristan has a certain carries himself certain, and there's a certain confidence to Tristan.
Yeah.
That's reminiscent of Tanner. Tanner didn't have to compete with Tristan last year. Tristan wasn't here. So now that Tristan's come in, I can tell you he's made that same kind of impression pretty quickly. But you can't usurp Tanner. Tanner's there, and he's built that. A lot of it started last year, and I'm going to talk to Tanner here pretty soon. We'll talk a little bit about that. Like, how did you do this last year? And then once the calendar flipped, he wasn't that much better than Patrick in the practices in terms of accuracy and passing. And there was times when I thought Tanner was a little risk-averse, and Patrick was a little bit more daring. But he was a little bit better, and he certainly has a quicker release, and he has a stronger arm. But I think the intangibles are the difference. So you could watch in spring practice sometimes. After a play, Tanner would go to this guy or this guy or this guy, and he'd be working with it. After a play, Patrick would be done, and he'd go over and stand by a GA. Not with his player.
Mm.
Now, that's not a knock on Patrick. What that's an indicator of is that it just takes time for a young guy who's 18, 19 years old from California to build that relational equity with people.
And also probably to gain confidence in what you're saying.
Right.
I'd imagine that, you know, if you're a second-year quarterback, you're still, you take your 8 reps in a row or whatever it is, and then you come off the field, your mind is probably trying, it's probably flooded with all this information and the coaching that you just got kind of like shoved at you into your face for this brief right. amount of time, and then you're also running plays. What just happened? You're trying to process it all, and I feel like the older you get, the faster that happens, and it also, you know, probably, like you said, just feel more comfortable speaking your mind, and you have those that kind of that equity built up with a lot of guys. So
I have empathy for Patrick because Patrick's in a tough spot. The guy behind him is the guy that came in with Keyshawn Johnson. He's already Keyshawn's best friend or one of his best friends. Built-in relationship.
Yeah. So, like, he can kind of get on, like, Keyshawn or and he'll probably already...
Built-in relationship with this Buki who's coming
right.
in.
Right. And Tyjon
built-in
Lindsey,
relationship with Tyjon Lindsey that yeah. Patrick doesn't have.
Mm-hmm.
Patrick's going to have to earn all that.
And then once you're already in with some of these guys, and then it's probably easier to sort of build and strengthen relationships with the other guys who you're going to be throwing to, too. So
if I were advising Patrick, I would say, look, man, you go make best friends with J.D. Spielman. You go find Javon McQuitty, and you go make friends with Javon McQuitty. And you go make friends with Spielman. Now, on top of that, go find Matt Snyder, Jack Stahl, all those tight ends, and you get in with them.
Yeah.
Because you got a guy behind you that's got built-in relationships. And the minute Tyjon gets on campus, you don't wait for him to go find his buddy Tristan. You go to him right away and say, hi, I'm Patrick. And I'm going to be your quarterback here in a couple of years. And you start, you make it a point. And that's not easy because coaches got to be smart about how they advise their players. But if I was advising Patrick, that's what I'd tell him to do. Go build your relational equity with these kids because Jebby has already got it.
Yeah.
And the other thing is fans already think Jebby is a better quarterback too. I watched enough of spring practice to know that I like a lot of the things that Jebby does. But long term, I think Patrick could be just as good and maybe better. But he's got to build that. And he's got to build the relational equity. You already see it with Jebbia. And Jebbia will stay in the office, and he'll be the gym rat and all that. Patrick has all that ability. Just got to unlock it, and then he's got to go and make relationships with some of these guys. I think Riley and Langsdorf appreciate the position that Patrick's in. I think they do, and hopefully they communicate to him, hey, look, we know we recruited a quarterback behind you who has all these relationships. So if I'm, you know, they need to advise him, go build him.
Yeah.
And make friends. I know that's a stupid thing to say, kind of. Go make friends. Tanner had it pretty easy because he never had to compete against Tommy for that. And I'm telling you this, too. There's a lot of guys that like Tanner in comparison to Tommy, not because they didn't like Tommy, but because Tanner's different than Tommy was. And I liked Tommy. I like Tommy's personality. I like Tommy's dad. I like the way they think, the way they laugh, the way they talk. Like, I like their vibe. I always liked Armstrong's vibe as a competitor. I'm like, I like you. You know, you want to have a little fun, but you're tough. Tanner's different, though. And sometimes that difference stands out as a positive contrast to the predecessor. And in that way, Tanner has this amazing relational equity, even though he's never played a down at Nebraska.
Right.
As part of his story. And if they're good this year, that piece is going to be a much bigger piece than people appreciate. It's not just going to be the physical stuff. It's going to be that relational equity that he was able to build up over the course of a year because of the unique situation he sort of dropped into. If that had been Patrick O'Brien, it would have been a whole different kettle of fish. Patrick would have had to earn all this relational equity. It would have been harder for him. Jebby would have competed with him right out of the box. It would have been a completely different thing. But with Tanner, it's almost been seamless. And when Riley says it's been seamless, he means it.
Yeah.
It's pretty interesting.
Right. Yeah, that part, and that'll continue through the summer. And so I'm actually eager to see kind of what you report on in terms of just, you know, how these guys are kind of meshing as a unit come fall camp. Because they'll have this 8-week stretch of workouts and drill work and all
comes
this stuff.
Comes down to that O-line, man. Comes down to Mike Kavanaugh.
Yeah, yeah.
And that
I know,
O-line.
We talked. It's fun to talk about the quarterbacks. But that may not be the biggest key for Nebraska.
It's going to be Mike Kavanaugh and that O-line, man. You better get to know that crew. If they can't figure that out, you know what's going to happen? You're going to go as a fan to Purdue. You going to go to the Purdue-Nebraska game as a fan?
Yeah, I went last year, man. It was
okay.
A god-awful game.
Yeah. So you're going to go to Purdue-Nebraska this year, yeah. And if they don't have that offensive line figured out, it's going to go down to the fourth quarter.
Right. Well, hopefully it'll be a little bit better play than last year. That's what I'm saying. Last year's game was just a...
I couldn't agree with you more. It was one of the worst played football games I've seen in a long time. Like a car crash over and over.
Yeah, I mean, it was just like two cars running into each other, like in a parking lot. Just, and you're watching, you're like, you just go around. You don't have to keep running into each other, but they kept running into it. You watch any of these baseball regionals? Did you watch any this last weekend? And super regionals coming up this weekend. I don't know. Does it pique your interest?
I've been watching softball. That ought to give you a commentary on what I think of the baseball.
Oh, yeah. Why is that? What's the, what leans you that way? Because I think the last 2 years, the softball championship series has outdrawn the baseball championship series, at least in terms of TV ratings. So you're not alone.
Yeah, I think some of that's because there is no pro softball league, and this is the best, this is the you highest level of softball.
Yeah, that's
the best
part
player,
of it.
Yeah.
You know it's the best.
Major leagues, but. College baseball is just too long, man.
Yeah.
I think, you know, Matt Schick and that crew does a great job with their.
I always get disappointed when they stop doing bases loaded.
Yeah. Don't get me wrong, I like it.
I'm a baseball guy, but it's hard to sit down and watch a full nine in a game. So when there's 16 different games going on at the same time and you can kind of cycle back and forth to the most exciting moments, that adds a lot of intrigue. But obviously you can't do that this weekend. You can't do that during the CWS. But, so it's unique to that weekend. But that's probably the best. It might be the best that college baseball has to offer for me. Unless
moves a lot faster.
I was going to say
there's a pace in softball that college baseball does and baseball period does not have.
Although I will say last night, Monday night, the epic 17-inning game. did not move quickly enough for me. I thought I was surprised by that.
It was 17 innings.
17 innings, so there had to be some pitching changes, so that happened, and some mound conferences and timeouts to discuss strategy. But it was pretty, pretty drama-filled.
Oh, yeah. Now, look, a 17-inning classic is one thing. That's kind of a different thing.
That's an outlier.
But generally speaking, it's just, I think college baseball has, it's not that I'm not interested. I've been reading about it in the paper.
Yeah.
Like what's going on in these regionals, and I'm interested. And if certain teams make it, I'll be interested. I need LSU to make the tournament. I need them to make the CWS. I don't really want to see TCU again. You? Well, you can't say, but I don't need to see like these small private schools with like three good pitchers make the tournament, like the CWS. I want these big, loud, vibrant fan bases to show up. You know, like
unfortunately, LSU's playing Mississippi State, because if you could get both of those teams up here, that'd be a lot of fun.
It would.
Oregon State or Vanderbilt, I don't think either school tends to
bring... Oregon State, yes. I want to watch them, though. That's an all-timer.
Yeah, what they've done this year, their pitching staff is phenomenal.
Although what they might do in this park is scary.
Good. Have a ridiculous.
They may not give up a run.
Yeah.
You've been watching a lot of it.
Yeah,
you have to.
A decent amount. Yeah.
What have you thought?
Like I told you, it still is tough to sit down and watch nine innings if you don't have a vested interest in it. You mentioned the slow pace of play, and that's an issue that the NCAA is concerned about and trying to still tinker with the best way to address it. And the difficult part is during the playoffs or the tournament, CWS, it's a different setting than the regular season. So you're there's a different set of parameters that you're worried about where you don't necessarily on March 25th on a Wednesday need your head coach to pull aside his hitter and kind of calm him down and say, hey, you can get this bunt down. The coach just lets him bunt because it's May 25th. But if it's June 10th, they're going to have these like little sidebars that just elongate the game, or the pitcher's taking a lap around the mound when he wouldn't normally do that. But, just so there's little pieces that drag the game out that can be tough for viewers. So, but the action on the field is still good. And I think that just the competitiveness and the parity within baseball this year is, although six SEC teams still made the super regionals, but I think you still had... I thought there was a little bit more diversity in the field, generally speaking, 64-team field, and saw some teams pull off some upsets. So I think that's good. Now for the CWS, I don't know if you really want maybe one Cinderella story. That's about it. But like you said, you kind of want the blue bloods to bring the fans and the brands and to make it fun for the long time CWS followers who kind of have relationships with some of these schools that have made it here a lot. So, honestly, the only thing I was disappointed with was Nebraska's quick exit. And I understand a lot of how Nebraska fans feel that too, but I thought that although it was going to be difficult to upset Oregon State, I thought they could have competed with them. I thought it could have been a fun couple games, and we just didn't get to see that.
So. How many years did you cover Darren Erstad's team?
Five?
Okay. So you know this team really well.
Decently well.
If you don't know this version of the team, you knew the other teams.
Better
than anybody. They have enough talent.
They have enough talent to win a regional. Probably not win a regional against a number one overall seed, but they should have done better than they did last year in that Clemson regional. They could have done better than they did in the Oklahoma State regional. But one of the missing pieces that I don't think I ever got a chance to write about it when I was going to, but then I switched beats. They just never have had that dominant ace. Other teams in the Big Ten have had it. You look across college baseball and a lot of the teams that make regionals, certainly the teams that make runs, have somebody to rely on who's had that sort of consistency, that demand, that sort of carries a presence on the mound and has the confidence of his guys behind him. I think they have pitchers who are gritty and they know how to get guys out and they're crafty at times, but they don't have anybody who's throwing, you know, 94 with a wicked breaking ball, whereas a lot of other teams have. I mean, they haven't had anybody who's going to be drafted, you know, in the top five rounds as a pitcher.
Why?
It's a good question, man. I think that they've tried to go after some guys who they thought that they could develop into it, but they haven't won the recruiting battles against the top-tier guys that I think that they've targeted. At least when I was covering the team, it may have been different now. And the other thing that's tough about it is when you are on a guy who is that elite level ace pitcher, number one, the pros are after him. And number two, all the other top tier programs are after him too. So you're kind of fighting off with both arms, trying to hold your place in terms of this guy's sphere of influence. Just stay there by, you know, on your left arm, you're pushing away the scouts, and the right arm, you're pushing away the other teams. But so that's part of it. I think, you know, projecting in Nebraska, I would imagine at this point, is working on 2019, 2020 in terms of recruiting. So you're sort of looking, you got a guy who you evaluate as a freshman in high school or a sophomore, and then you have to figure out, is he going to be legitimate by that time? When he's a sophomore in college and be that ace that you need him to be. So, and you know, and development too. I don't know if they've developed some of their top tier arms, the guys who they really were excited about getting into the program. Have they developed them as well as they could have? I don't, maybe those guys haven't just panned out the way that they thought they would have. But so it's a lot of different things. But I think that if you're looking for me, I mean, I know everyone focuses on the offense kind of hitting the skids at the wrong time, but to me, that's kind of cyclical, and that's baseball. Like, you're going to have stretches where you just can't hit, especially if you're in Nebraska and you're not full, your lineup's not full of guys who are getting, you know, a team like Florida has like half its lineups getting drafted. You know, that Nebraska's not going to have that. But, you know, if you can't rely on that number one to sort of set the tone, and then you have a guy like Jake Myers in your two spot, which is like, I feel like a nice fit for him. But yeah, I mean, what they've done with the program is commendable. You know, they've taken the program out of the doldrums where it wasn't making the Big 12, and there was just a Big 12 tournament, and there was,
man, they had the talent to do it.
Yeah,
too.
Right.
They had more talent then than they do now.
You can make that argument too. Oh,
it's pretty easy to make
that
it.
The Big 12 teams during the end of the Mike Anderson era are just as talented as the ones that Nebraska has at this moment.
No question.
There was just a mental entanglement of issues.
Had as good of a pitcher as Michael Marriott since Michael Marriott, who was like an 09 or oh, I don't even know. I mean, their talent now, other than Ryan Bolt, they had better talent back then.
Yeah, I mean, even those teams had Cody Ashe on there.
Oh, right? Yeah.
So, I think they've taken a jump. They've moved out of that funk that they were in for a few years. But now the question is, what plan is in place to take the program up to the next level? I mean, I talked to Darren a couple times, Darren Arsett a couple times about this, because he understands if you go into the NCAA tournament as a 2 or 3 seed, I mean, the odds are stacked against you. Your goal, if you want to make a run in the NCAA tournament, you have to get a regional. You have to be a consistent regional host. 67% of those teams advance to the next round. That's where you have to be. So if Nebraska's talking about College World Series, and that's what Darren talks about, and that's what the standard is, fans want that, Nebraska's got to host regionals. So you got to be a top 16 team in the country, or at least have a team that's a top 25 team in contention for one of those top 16 bids. So that means a talent upgrade. It means finding that top-tier pitcher. It means maybe figuring out a way to avoid having players getting, I don't know, were they pressing? Were they tight? Whatever has been the source, or potentially could be the source offensively the last couple of years, addressing that. But yeah, it was disappointing to see Nebraska bow out so quickly, just because I thought, given that they had the other two teams in that regional of Holy Cross and Yale. It's like, you know, you can handle those teams, and then you get your shot against the best team in the country. Who knows what can happen, because you'll be playing with a little bit of we've got nothing to lose attitude, and maybe grit your teeth a little bit. And I feel like Nebraska in that role was pretty good, but they just couldn't create themselves that opportunity because they played so poorly against the other two teams.
So how many guys this is going to sound like an off the wall question, but I'll get to my point. How many guys does Greg McDermott normally play in his rookie?
Eight, nine. Right, yeah.
Eight. So if I told you that the number eight guy in that rotation, even the number seven guy, let's say number seven guy off, you know, second guy off the bench,
right,
was an undersized walk-on guard who was a freshman. Based on that person's placement in the roster, is that a Sweet 16 team? Does that team have Sweet 16 talent if the seventh best player on the team is a undersized walk-on guard who's a freshman?
Probably not, but, you know, basketball's a little bit different. I know you're trying to make an analogy, but, because sometimes all you need is a couple guys, and they can just carry you.
True.
But most likely no, because then they will get exploited when they're on the field against, or on the court against, better competition, the type of competition that they're going to have to face to get to that Sweet 16 spot. Right.
So Nebraska's rolling out a guy in their top nine who is a 5'7" walk-on freshman, and he's one of the top players on the team. Mm-hmm. That has nothing to do with him. To me, that's a commentary on the rest of the team. If that guy who could not earn a scholarship out of high school from your university is a walk-on and he's undersized and he's one of your top players, that means he's better than all the guys that you decided to give scholarships to. That means one of two things. A, you should have given a scholarship to this guy because he's better. B, the guys that you did give the scholarships to weren't as good as the guy that you didn't. And to me, you could apply that to any sport. And if you have a story like that, then how talented can you be? Like, is that really... Is it really a mindset issue, or is it a ball play? Like, you got to have better players. And I think there isn't any question that Nebraska basketball, because everybody's talking about Nebraska football and basketball and baseball and this whole long question about, well, they had a bad year. There isn't any question that 2 or 3 years ago, Nebraska basketball just didn't have the players. They didn't have the players. I don't care. Durant, Pettaway, and then a bunch of guys is what they had. Well, Shields, but even Siobhan Shields didn't get a cup of coffee in the NBA. So, like, there's this conversation to be had about the level of player that you're getting in the program. And you mentioned it with the ace. I couldn't even tell you. I'd have to look it up. Who's the last great pitcher they had drafted?
The last, like, great pitcher?
Not great's the wrong word. I mean...
Because they've had talented guys who've gotten drafted but didn't necessarily perform...
In the top 10 rounds,
you know,
though.
Phenomenally at Nebraska. I'm trying to think of where Max Knutson got drafted last year. He was probably a 12th rounder.
I just think
he didn't necessarily do much.
I don't know. They're going to have... to me, it's just sort of a challenge to, like, get great. You gotta get better players in the program. That to me is the key. If you look at the recruiting rankings according to Perfect Game, which is imperfect, admittedly imperfect, you know, you just don't love what you're seeing there. So who was it? I mean, who was the last guy that got drafted high? Aaron Bummer.
No, he was a 19th round pick. Michael Marriott was the last pitcher from Nebraska to be drafted in the top 10 rounds.
I didn't look that up ahead of time. Just so you know,
Michael
Marriott is the last pitcher I thought was really good. And Michael was their ace. And questioned whether he was very good, partially because he played for a pretty dysfunctional team. But Michael was a pretty good player. And then Mike Nesith, who was always hard for me to say his last name, had a lot of talent, but then he got hurt and then he went in the 17th round. But it's just been a long time. It's been since Tony Watson that they've had a guy that you're like, man, or Johnny Dorn, But Johnny wasn't drafted real high. What was he drafted in the 15th round?
Right.
Johnny was a true ace. But it's just been a long time since they've had a great pitcher.
And my other thing, too, is like you don't necessarily have to be a top 10 round draft pick to be an ace in college, but you do, you would like to see a guy get drafted a little bit. I mean, usually there's some sort of parallel there. And Nebraska hasn't had that in a while. And when you look at some of the teams they've lost to, they've gone up against a ball club that has a really quality starting pitcher. Especially last year was more evident than this year. Last year was sort of the peak of that conversation in my mind, because they had to play two games against in the Big Ten tournament, were against really quality eventual MLB draft picks,
mm-hmm.
and then they played in the NCAA tournament against more draft picks. I believe. I know the Oklahoma State kid was really good, but
yeah, it's just to me it feels like Anderson was actually a pretty good recruiter, and he struggled to get what for whatever reason he could not get that thing all the way put together. But if you look at they had, I don't know how many draft picks they have in 2015, they had quite a few, and in 20 like that the 2015 season was just so. The 2014 season was pretty good. You look at the players that they've kind of bled, and then this year, I don't know who's getting drafted. I think Luis Alvarado's going to get drafted as a pitcher, which he didn't really do a lot of.
Yeah.
Schreiber might get drafted. Ben Miller will probably get drafted.
Yeah.
Although I don't think Miller's gotten better, really.
He got drafted last year, so I'd imagine. But then again, as a senior, sometimes the pros just say, well, we'll just pick you up as an undrafted
agent. So if they lose Schreiber, if he decides to leave, because he can go now, and they lose Alvarado, you look at their recruiting rankings according to Perfect Game, and I think for the 2017 class, it's 95. And for the 2016 class, it was 69. And I think for the 2014 class, the 2015 class, I think it was 92. Now, maybe those Perfect Game rankings are just screwed up.
Some of them are. I mean, I think ranking prospects in baseball is tough.
That doesn't look good.
You'd want to be higher than that. I'll give you that.
That's kind of down where Creighton's at. And we don't need to belabor the point with Creighton. But it's just, to me, it just doesn't feel like they have enough players. And you look at sort of what's going on with Nebraska's athletic department. I know a lot of people are fired up about it. I think the basketball thing really needs to be figured out from a systemic standpoint. And they really need to decide whether Tim Miles is the dude. And he has a year to figure that out, and he needs to change some things, and players do, and whatever. Because I think they have the talent to win 18, 19 games.
Yeah, it's a pretty good roster. The question, though, it's just there's a cloud over the program as to whether or not, is it their job security here, and last year did no favors, I don't think, to diminish that conversation at all. Not just internally, obviously externally, but
still got Thomas Allen. I mean, they still got a guy that I think would fit on a lot of really good teams. So yeah, I don't think I think talent is okay. The football team and the baseball team, I'm telling you, a lot of it is talent.
Yeah.
So not all of it. I get that. They shouldn't have lost 40-10 to Iowa in football. And they shouldn't have lost by 59 to Ohio State. Riley could have steered that ship home and they lost by 30 instead of half 100, but it's talent.
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. You commend Darren Hurst for taking the program up, but to get to that next level, Nebraska's making regionals or competing for Big Ten titles and making regionals. That's pretty good. It's a good place to be, but you want more than that, so you got to get better players.
I feel like they got to get better players. I don't think the issue with Hurst is his management ability or his personality. I think his players respond to him. You never hear guys coming out of the program being like, or you don't even hear whispers of, boy, that Darren, that Coach Hurst gets on our nerves. I'm telling you, you've heard that stuff with the basketball coach. And I don't know that I don't necessarily share that feeling about Miles, but you've heard it. Like, this guy is tough, and we don't know what to do. Like, we don't jibe with him. You never hear that about Erstad. So I think it's more an issue of you just need better baseball players. Like, you need a few dudes who can rake. And you need it, like you said, an ace. Speaking of recruiting, I know you wanted to talk about Tugs Bowen.
Brian Bowen! Yeah, didn't go to Creighton. Went.
Did that? Now, how... obviously Tugs Bowen isn't going to say anything about this, but how much did that, you know, internally, was Creighton A, surprised that he went to Louisville, and B,
yeah,
hurt? Like, oh boy, this was a blow. Like, no, we really expected.
Yeah, you know, here's my read on it. My thought is, from Creighton's standpoint, knowing those coaches, well, number one, you kind of have to have this sort of mindset of it's not over. So you have to play the game. I mean, they lost Marcus Foster to Kansas State, not as high profile, obviously, but a guy they really wanted. And it turned out, after 2 years, Kansas State didn't work out. He was back on the market.
That's fair. Good
so
point.
With Brian Bowen, you kind of have to have that same mindset. That's one. Number two, I guarantee, just knowing these guys for the year that I've covered the team, that it's fired them up to do more. I think they understood getting into this, the recruitment of Brian Bowen, even though they knew that they had to reserve a scholarship for him. And I would assume, I'm almost certain that they had to at least tell other potential recruits or transfers to hold on, or they had to just let them make their decision, because they wouldn't wait for Brian Bowen to make his decision. So even though they may have lost some battles, I think that they knew going into it that this is where they want to be. I mean, if you're Creighton basketball and you're playing in the Big East against some of these programs that are obviously extremely committed to competing on the national level, you got to recruit. You got to recruit well. Creighton put together its best class in history, at least in recruiting rankings history. It was a top 25 class. You got three guys who are top 100 players. For the most part, I mean, depending on the recruiting service, but on average, top 100 players, and it's rated well. So they did their job. They would have liked to have gotten their biggest prize, obviously. Brian Bowen is an instant impact guy, prolific scorer, potential, would have started from day one and probably would have elevated Creighton from the middle of the pack of the Big East, where it is right now, I think, to the top tier of the Big East.
Right.
He's that good. He is a really good player. Now, Creighton can mesh well as a team and figure out from a personnel standpoint who fits where and X's and O's and scheme their way to a top-tier finish in the Big East. But I think right now, from a talent standpoint, you look at all the players that are coming back, majority of the top players in the Big East, I think it was something like 13 of the top 18 scorers returned to the conference.
That means it's going to be tough.
It's going to be tough. And Creighton's already kind of put together a tough non-conference schedule. So it's going to be a grind each day.
Brutal.
Yeah. Half of its games are against NCAA tournament teams. That's what it's going to be. So that's not going to be easy, obviously. And when you're talking about Creighton losing, they figured out a little bit. They got a taste of how to play without their point guard. And they're losing their NBA draft prospect in Justin Patton. And they didn't get the guy that they really went after in Brian Bowen in their recruiting. In the 2017 recruiting cycle, it hurts, and there's a lot of work to be done. But I do think it is a good sign if you're a Creighton fan that at least Creighton's trying to fight these battles. You don't want to be sitting the sidelines and not being in the room or at least in the conversation for some of these top-tier recruits, because you need them to take the next step if you're Creighton. So
why Louisville?
Why Louisville? I know, that's a great question, and I don't know the answer to that other than member of what was reported in the Louisville paper was that a member of Brian Bowen's camp reached out to Louisville a couple weeks ago and just said, are you guys interested? They hadn't been talking for a year and a half, and obviously, whatever reason, my sort of thought is that Brian Bowen just never felt comfortable coming to Creighton. Creighton's not the entity that, it's not a big brand. It's not, you come to Creighton, you maybe in a smaller sphere, you're kind of a big deal. Private school, walking around campus, you're a big deal, but nationally, Creighton can get overlooked. It's got a nice fan base in-house, but it's not like an internet-heavy retweet, like all your social media stuff, fan base. You know, they're not in the conversation a ton. Maybe that just didn't fit his star power sort of mentality. A lot of guys are looking at building their brands and trying to be best positioned so that when the NBA draft or when the NBA scouts come around, they'll be on their radar. You don't want to be overlooked or have to fight your way up the ladder. So maybe that was part of it because, a player of his caliber, at least rated as highly as he is, five-star recruit, top 20 consensus player in the country. No one like that has come to Creighton before. I mean, now I think the highest rated recruit, I think, before this season, I'd have to go back and look at it, but I think before this season is Justin Patton, who, you know, he was not on anybody's radar until his senior year. And even then,
P. Allen.
He was a top 100 player, but I think Patton was rated higher, at least maybe according to Rivals. But P. Allen, I mean, Ronnie Harrell, I think, is a top 100 player according to Rivals, too.
But P. Allen came with baggage, right? Yeah. So, like, the one guy that did come here, and Justin was, you know, great, but he's only here a year because he went to the NBA. But P. Allen came with baggage. Yeah. Like, he was a hard guy for Dana to work with.
So, Creighton's going to have to... They have to fight. They have to get in those battles, and so their hope is that they can learn their lessons, figure out a way to win some of them. And they're in on a number of really talented 2018 recruits, some top 50 guys that are instant impact players, and they have to win. I mean, you have to win some of those battles, because if you don't, you're just going to fall behind some of the top tier programs in the Big East. That's just reality. Because
so you think this came down to ultimately Creighton and Louisville. Because you say, Creighton, he didn't want to go to Creighton, but he could have gone to Michigan State or Arizona.
Well, I think Arizona and Michigan State sort of fell back in the Bowen sweepstakes once their stars came back.
Do you think this came down to Creighton and Louisville?
I think Oregon was probably in the mix as well. And I'd imagine, I mean, I'd be hard pressed to think that DePaul was not in the mix. I mean, they hired his high school coach. You'd think that he was, I'm sure, interacting with the kid and trying to get him to come there. And one of his good friends, his good buddy, is a point guard. Who is actually a 2019 kid who's going to reclassify to 2018, Tiger Campbell, he committed to DePaul, and he's a really good player. And he was a guy that a lot of people estimated was a Michigan State lean. Like, maybe he had already softly committed to Michigan State, and then the coach left La Lumiere and went to DePaul, and everyone thought, well, as soon as they got Campbell, it was like, well, that means something. So I think I think the troubling moment for Creighton that when the alarm bells went off, at least for me, was after Miles Bridges decided to come back to Michigan State and Alonzo Trier decided to come back to Arizona, and they didn't get a commitment within the next few days from Brian Bowen, because those three teams at that point in mid-March, late March, early April, looked like the leaders: Creighton, Arizona, Michigan State. And once you sort of eliminated Michigan State, Arizona from that group because of the talent that they were returning and, you know, just the likelihood that Bowen, if he went there, wouldn't start and his shots would be limited, playing time be limited, just because they'd have veterans ahead of him, better players, proven players ahead of him. When they didn't land him at that point, I was like, oh, you know. And then he took a visit to Oregon, and then
things started happening. Did they create this non-conference schedule
to lure him?
No. Oh. Well, I'm telling you right now that Nebraska women's basketball created that absurd, insane schedule that they did the last 2 years. Connie set it up before she, you know, resigned. That, I mean, you better believe that was in part for Jessica Shepherd.
Yeah.
To play UConn twice, and they had it set up, well, hey, if we win these two games, we get to play Washington, and then we play Notre Dame. Like, they set it up, and they were intending to have Jessica have a chance to play all the top teams. Like, they thought that when Jessica came in, that was going to be the next step. They were going to take a next level kind of deal. So, but you made a really good point about their brand, okay? The Big East, while having a good brand, doesn't have the same brand as the ACC, even though Villanova won the national title. How does Creighton improve its brand, and how much can it control that?
Yeah, I don't know if you can. I think the only way you can control it is by winning and playing tough teams, good teams, teams that have that brand, and beating them on big stages and making NCAA tournament runs. I mean, NCAA tournament runs is the next step, I think, for the program. They got to get to a Sweet 16. They want to build that brand further. But you asked about the schedule. I don't know if it was necessarily for Brian Bowen. I'm sure it doesn't hurt. But the Gonzaga series was in the works for a while.
Okay.
They're just trying to find the right time to make it work for both sides.
Right.
They're going to Kansas City. They've been trying to do that for a while too, and I think they missed that opportunity of having Jays fans travel to a non-conference, or, you know, a non-Omaha site like St. Louis. You know, that used to be such a fun trip for a lot of Jays fans. They can kind of maybe recreate it a little bit, going KC for a couple days, playing some good teams. Northwestern, that's a Gavitt game, so that's a year-to-year thing. Creighton's played in it. Will now
used
be
used to get knocked for its schedule. I mean, most people would say, hey, you know what?
Last year, I honestly thought last year's schedule was doable. I mean, you ended up playing 12 games against NCAA tournament teams in conference play. So as long as you didn't fill your non-conference with a ton of cupcakes, we were fine. And Creighton, I thought, had a decent schedule last year. Maybe one more marquee game I would have liked, but it ended up being ranked outside the top 200 non-conference strength of schedule, which is probably not the place you'd want to be, especially right. if you're 10-8 in the league. Maybe you're 9-9 in the league. What if you're 8-10 in the league and you have a 200 ranked yeah. non-conference strength of schedule? You got to bump that up. So they did in a big way. They're testing themselves even further.
I think that's part of the. I just think what you said there was just really. I couldn't agree more.
Yeah.
You know, you want to get these great players, and short of actually making the NCAA tournament run, how do you do it? Yeah. That's a great point. I suppose you can always try to do it with an international pipeline. I think Gonzaga has benefited from that.
Yeah.
But, you know, you may also not want to do the international thing. Some people don't want to do that.
Right.
And Creighton obviously doubt, you know.
They have a couple guys.
They have a couple. But
had a couple over the last few
years. I don't think it's like their number one passion. Right. I think they'd rather get in high school. So that's really interesting. I think that's one of the fascinating things about recruiting. I remember Bill Snyder talking about this, and Snyder's been in the news for recruiting stuff, and he made a huge mistake there. But he said, you know, I remember him saying once, hey, we started getting into the right living rooms after we won the Big 12 championship in 02 or 03, and they had this run. He's like, you know, we started getting into a different caliber living room. But the problem was we didn't win the battles. We didn't win any of them. And when we when we didn't win them, we spent all this time going after guys that we never got. And our overall talent pool went down because we ended up getting guys that weren't as good as the guys we could have got.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really good way of looking at it. Nebraska faces the exact same dilemma. I mean, Nebraska football is a bigger brand than Creighton basketball. But given the team size and given where Nebraska football is right now versus Creighton basketball, their brand's pretty similar. And so I think for Nebraska, it's always that hard question of, and they've run up against this with wide receiver. And you've covered Husker football recruiting, so you've seen it. How many years in a row did we talk about, well, Rich Fisher's going after this guy?
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, Keith Williams is going after this guy, Des Fitzpatrick, or whatever. And outside of Tajon, and I guess Keyshawn Johnson, but I don't count him as much as I do Tajon Lindsey. They've kind of missed, and that goes back with Rich, too. And I liked Rich Fisher. But they were always in on four or five star they didn't get. You know, they had that ridiculous Demoreye Stringfellow saga. Oh, he didn't even get drafted, by the way, out of Ole Miss. But that kind of stuff is hard for Nebraska too. Like, how do you get top 50 and top 100 kids to come here? Not because you're not a good recruiter, not because you're not organized, but how do you get them? How do you get Foster Sorrell, the number one tackle in the country, when at the end of the day, you did everything you could to win that recruiting battle, and then he says, but I grew up wanting to go to Stanford. And believe me, that crushed Mike Rowe. He wouldn't have brought it up at the press conference on signing day if he weren't pissed that they put in the effort, and they did everything they did only to have this kid say, but did you know I grew up wanting to play at Stanford? Thanks, kid. So it's a big question. It's the exact same thing. Foster Sorrell was kind of like Tugs Bowen. And it's just a tough deal because you got to win them. You're exactly right.
Yep.
Sooner or later, you got to find a way. And you got to find a way without having to hire John Blake to do it. Because Nebraska football actually got a few of those guys back in the mid-2000s, but they had to hire John Blake to achieve it. And he did bring them in Ndamukong Suh, and he did bring them Marlon Lucky and a few others, but he also was John Blake. And, like, you know, he broke all kinds of NCAA rules at North Carolina, and he didn't coach his own guys here at Nebraska very well. So you got to find a way to do it, but you also got to find a way to do it with the right coaches. And, you know, Tajon was good. Bookie Radley Hiles is better because he's a better player, and he's the kind of kid who's like a leader. And so, like, somehow they convinced this kid through, like, 3 years of recruiting his buddies. They got this guy who's like a ringleader.
Right.
He's a ringleader for all these other guys. And so I feel like they've got a guy now in Radley Hiles who can, like, get everybody else. And ideally you'd like it to be a quarterback, and they were trying to get the kid from Houston, Grant Gunnell, to be that guy.
Yep.
and he commits to A&M. Yep. And he committed to A&M 18 months before signing day. And it must be so frustrating in Nebraska because they're like, why would the number one quarterback in a class commit to a school where the coach might get fired? What is he doing? Like, why is he doing that? Because you still want to recruit the kid, but now he's like, he's going out with another girl. And you're like, oh my God.
But you, yeah, but you don't want to give up necessarily.
Yeah. Yeah, I know you don't want to give up, but it's like, what? You got to go offer someone else is my point. You can't just sit there and wait for the kid to wise up. You got to go out and offer the kid from Council Bluffs, who's a good player, but he's not the number one quarterback in America. So, you know, it's like, it's a challenge because they waited all this time for this Bone kid. As you said, they might have had to say no to some other guys who might be very good players in order to pull it off. Yeah. And now they're kind of left, just like, you know, they're left holding the spot.
Yep.
And that's tough. That's a tough deal.
It'll be interesting because, and that's one of the things, they felt like they were pretty in pretty good shape in 2017 because they had three guys already committed to the class.
Right.
So 2018, when they raise that standard and try to go after some top-tier guys, will they have that security blanket? Will they have guys already sort of in the fold that they know they can rely on that will be really good players and, like you said, kind of boost the talent level, the overall talent level of the program while they still kind of shoot for the moon and go after some of the best players in the class? We'll see. We'll see what their plan is. I'm eager to see it unfold this summer and see if they've figured out maybe some lessons learned.
This was a good podcast.
Yeah, we talked for a long time.
Did we?
But that's all right. I enjoyed it.
I got a meeting to go to.
Yeah.
I'd rather sit here and talk for longer. Thank you for being patient, Sasha.
Sasha, the producer. Best in the biz. All right, Sam.
She really is.
Yeah. We'll talk again soon.
All right, sir.
Later.